Well, good morning, church family. Before I begin with the message today, I'd like to talk about a little bit about Blue Mountain Television. Keith mentioned it's premiere week. How many know what premiere week means? Not too many. So we are launching a new schedule on Blue Mountain Television. So what that means, we have new programs, we have new episodes of current programs. So starting tomorrow, we have brand new episodes of The Incredible Journey. We have brand new episodes of Lifestyle Magazine this week. Gospel Outreach was mentioned. On Friday, we're going to do new episodes of Gospel Outreach. So they have revamped their program just a little bit. So we're going to start with that. And then they have a new program as well called Destination 1040, where their videographer, Aaron Rittenauer, and his wife went overseas to some of these villages. So that's what you're going to see on Gospel Outreach coming up. It's going to kind of be a mixture between those two programs. And then we're also transitioning from Dwight Nelson to Shane Anderson. Shane Anderson is a new pastor of the Pioneer Memorial Church. So next Sabbath, he's been at that church since July, but next Sabbath is the first sermon from Shane Anderson on Pioneer Media from Pioneer Memorial Church. And so I've been listening to some of his sermons, and it's really good. So I know you guys will be blessed. The schedule in the evening has changed just a little bit. We're moving our church services up to 6 p.m. We have conversations with John Bradshaw. We're going to be doing new episodes of that as well. And then in the evening, we're going to be doing some more exciting different programs like Authentic and It Is Written and Story Encounters with David and Ty. And then on Thursday evening is Hometown. Hometown is a production that we have been working on at Blue Mountain Television for some time. And so we're excited to bring this to you here, the viewers. And so Thursday at 8 p.m. is Hometown. We're doing some studio interviews. We're doing interviews out in the community. And so the first one is going to be on the Children's Museum in Walla Walla, as well as a fencing instructor explaining how that brings perseverance to our lives. So I know you'll be in blessed by that program. So let's tune in on Thursday evening at 8 p.m. for Hometown. So, our message today is entitled, A River of Influence. So as we begin, I'd like to ask you a question. Is influence a good thing or is it a bad thing? It can be both. Let's look at the dictionary term of influence. It says, the capacity or power of persons or things to be a compelling force on or produce effects on the actions, behavior, opinions of others. So like we've noted, influence can be a good thing, can certainly be a bad thing as well. If I'm influencing you to eat your fruits and veggies, that's probably a good thing, right? But if I'm influencing you to watch something that's not appropriate or do some smoking or drinking or any of those types of things, I'm sure we would consider those bad influence. So today I'd like to take a look at a couple people in the Bible that had a good influence and somebody that had a really, really bad influence. And then we'll look at how we can be good influence on those around us. But I'd like to begin with a story. Now I've told this story on Daily Bread before, so please forgive me if you've already heard this story. But back when I was in college, I spent two summers at Camp Wakanda in Wisconsin, summer of 2002 and summer of 2003. I was a maintenance director there, helping keep everything working the first summer. The second summer, I did maintenance, and then I also did the week in review videos. So I'd go film a bunch of things that were happening on camp, and then we'd show it at the end on Saturday night. So the campers really looked forward to the video that I was able to put together for them each week. We always started with blind camp, and then we worked our way up in the age group. We ended with family camp, which was a whole different ball of wax. But This story that I want to share takes place during teen camp. So it was right towards the end of camp, and it was the second summer that I was there. Teen camp, we did something completely different than we did for any of the other camps. We did what was called outposts. And as campers arrived on Sunday, they got to pick one of five outposts that they could be a part of. Horseback riding, canoeing, water skiing, rock climbing, or outdoor living. One of those five. They got to put their top three choices, and then the staff would kind of put together who got to go on which one. Now, the rest of the staff got put on different outposts because all the staff went on these because they needed people to help. And so the first year, I went on the outdoor living one. The second year, I was on the canoe trip. Now, the way outposts work is Tuesday morning, you would have breakfast, and then there would be the morning worship. And right after morning worship, everybody would get in vehicles, and they would go out away from the camp. They would go out to the rocks and do rock climbing. They'd go out to a lake and do water skiing. And then they'd camp out at that location. The next morning, they'd do a little bit more of that activity and then be back in the evening in time for the evening meal and then evening meeting. So that was the way outposts worked. Like I said, I was on the canoe trip the second year. And we had this thing that we decided that we were going to do. And that was we were going to put one staff canoe in the front, one staff canoe in the back, and all of the campers had to stay in between. We didn't want them running on ahead or lollygagging behind. Now, I got stuck in the canoe that was in the back of the group. Not a big deal, except they took off and they left us with one paddle. And so we were lollygagging way behind. We finally caught up to the group because they'd pulled off to the side. And we said, can we get a second paddle? There was a few. And so we were able to do just that. We were able to get a second paddle. But the other staff member that was with me, Luke, he didn't really care. He was out to have an enjoying, relaxing time. So we ended up lollygagging behind again. And then we finally get to this, we could see up a ways where they had pulled off to take another break, another rest. And the river kind of came up and then it went around the bend at this point. But as we're getting close, we're maybe two football fields away from where they're at, we kind of ran aground. The water was only so deep. And with all the weight in the canoe, we weren't going to be able to go anywhere. So we got out of the canoe. It kind of floated on the water. And we were running across this field up to where they were at. Now, what we didn't realize is that there was a 6-foot drop-off in the water. We didn't see it. All of them up there knew what was going to happen because they had been through it just before, just themselves. And so as we're running, all of a sudden, we're under the water and there's the canoe just floating along. Now, it was really interesting because Luke, who was with me, said, oh, that was fun. So he went and parked the canoe, and then he's out doing it over and over and again. And next thing you know, all of the campers are out there having fun, running along and splashing into the water. We did that for quite some time, but then what we ended up doing is there was another staff member that I was friends with, Matt. He and I were kind of swimming in this area a little bit, and what we noticed is that there was a current that kind of ran through and then went around. And so we thought, well, let's see where the current goes, and we kind of let the current take us just a little bit. And then he and I looked at each other, and we went, this is not good. We could tell the current was going to take us. So we were able to swim out and get onto the sandbar, which wasn't too far away. But we turned around and looked, and here's a camper following us. Oh, no. We're telling her, no, go back, get back. But she was stuck, and she couldn't get out. And her friends were following her. Oh, this was treacherous. So Matt and I went back in. Now, I'm not the greatest swimmer in all the world, and so it was a little difficult for me to try and help a camper stay afloat and stay afloat myself. But we were doing the best we can, and there was some people that was with us. There was a bunch of other staff. I mean, there was a whole group that were in the water trying to do what we could do. Meanwhile, our adult sponsor on this trip, Pastor Bird, was talking with a local, and the local right about this time says, you know, that's not a good spot for them to be swimming. It's very dangerous around that corner. There's people that have lost their lives on this corner because of that current. And it's at that point, somebody yelled, help. And he, I'm told, did a Superman leap into the canoe and was over quickly to where we were at. And we were able to get all of the campers into the canoe. And the rest of us staff were hanging on. We were able to get ourselves out of that situation, out of the trouble that we had gotten ourselves into. And thankfully, the only thing we lost in that whole incident was a flotation cushion on one of the canoes. So no lives were lost. That was quite the experience that I had. But you see, the influence that Luke had in getting everybody to have fun and play there in the water. And you also see the influence that Matt and I inadvertently had on the rest of the campers and got themselves in such a dire situation. So today, I'd like to look at, like I mentioned earlier, a story in the Bible. A good influence and really, a really unfortunately bad one. But we've got to do a whole bunch of setup. So the children of Israel, they have left Egypt. They've crossed the Red Sea. They're traveling in the desert. And they get to Mount Sinai. And there at Mount Sinai, God gives them his law. And you remember, there was a lot of thundering and lightning and all sorts of stuff as God told them his law. In Exodus 20, verse number 18 and verse number 19, it says, now all the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightning flashes, and the sound of the trumpet, and the mountain smoking, and when they saw it, and the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. Then they said to Moses, you speak with us, and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die. So what's going on here is they see how God is speaking to them and they're like, yeah, we don't want anything to do with that. They're terrified. They're petrified. And so they come to Moses and they say, Moses, you speak with us. You go talk with God. You get the stuff from him and then you come and you talk with us. You share with us. So we fast forward a little bit to Exodus chapter 24 and verse number 12. This is the Lord said to Moses, come to me on the mountain and be there, and I will give you the tablets of stone and the law and the commandments which I have written that you may teach them. So, this arrangement seems to be something that God is okay with and Moses is okay with because God is calling Moses to come up onto the mountain so that he can give them the Ten Commandments that he's already spoken. He can write them down and he's going to give some other commandments to Moses to give to the people. And so Moses follows through. Verses 16 to 18 of Exodus 24. Now the glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. The sight of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the top of the mountain in the eyes of the children of Israel. So Moses went into the midst of the cloud and went up in the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. So, you have this huge, awesome display that's taking place. And God calls Moses in the midst of all of this to come commune with him. So he does that, and the people, I'm sure, a little confused and terrified over this. But let me ask you a question. What were the people supposed to do while Moses was up on the mountain? Patriarchs and Prophets, page 315. During this period of waiting, there was time for them to meditate upon the law of God, which they had heard, and to prepare their hearts to receive further revelation that he might make to them. Unfortunately, they had none too much time for this work, and they had they been thus seeking a clearer understanding of God's requirements and humbling their hearts before him, they would have been shielded from temptation. But they did not do this, and they soon became careless, inattentive, and lawless. So, if they had been, well, they didn't have the written word at that point, but if they had been meditating upon God's word, they would have been shielded from a lot of what happens next. And I think that's a lesson for us, and we'll unpack that here in a little bit. But let's take a look at what happens next. Exodus chapter 32 is where we'd like to spend the bulk of our time. Now, when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us gods that shall go before us. For as this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." So Moses delays in coming down the mountain. At least that's how they perceive it. He was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. And it looked like with all that had taken place, they'd seen him go into that awesome display. They figured he was probably consumed. He's probably gone. He's not coming back. So what do they ask for? They ask for an idol. Now, I find this kind of interesting, because if they had been meditating upon God's word and they had been paying attention, what did God say to them just a few chapters ago? No, this is not a good idea. The Ten Commandments, you shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness, or of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them, nor serve them. For the Lord your God am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children of the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments. So he's like, no. This is not a good idea. I don't want you to do this. Don't make any graven image. Now, I find it interesting. It says he's going to visit to the third and the fourth generation. Really, what's happening here, I believe, is that the sins of the father get passed on through influence to the son, and so on and so on and so forth. So it's not that he's visiting physical punishment. It's the fact that the sins of the father are repeated by the sons, and so on and so forth. So this is a big no-no, to build an altar, an idol. Patriarchs and prophets says the people desired some image to represent God and to go before them in the place of Moses. God had given no manner of similitude of himself, and he had prohibited any material representation for such a purpose. They wanted an image to represent God. I don't think they were trying to say God didn't do this. What they were saying is, we want something that represents God. But God had forbidden that. So they go to Aaron and they say, "Aaron, this is what we want. Please do it." Aaron, unfortunately, did not live up to leadership status. Such a crisis demanded a man of firmness, decision, and unflinching courage, one who held the honor of God above popular favor, personal safety, or life itself. But the present leader of Israel was not of this character. Aaron feebly remonstrated with the people, but his wavering and timidity at the critical moment only rendered them the more determined. I find this really interesting. Aaron fears for his life more than standing up for what's right. Aaron certainly had a chance to say, "Nope, not a good idea, shouldn't do it." And because he was so timid and didn't stand up for the right, the people were more determined than they had been in the first place. Later on, she says, if Aaron had courage to stand for the right, irrespective of the consequences, he could have prevented that apostasy. If he had unswervingly maintained his own allegiance to God, if he had cited the people to the perils of Sinai and had reminded them of their solemn covenant with God to obey his law, the evil would have been checked. But his compliance with the desire of the people and the calm assurance with which he proceeded to carry out their plans emboldened them to go to greater lengths in sin than had before ever entered their minds. Because of his fickleness, because he couldn't stand up and say no, if he had been meditating on God's word like we mentioned earlier, this probably wouldn't have happened. He would have had that determination to stand for what was right. But he didn't. And because he was a little fickle in the way he handled it, they were ready to go further than they originally planned. So how does Aaron respond to the people? Verse 2, and Aaron said to them, break off the gold earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. See, I think what's happening here is he sees a way that he can get out of this. He's not going to say no, but he's going to say, hey, give me your earrings. He's hoping that they'll come and say, well, those are too precious. We don't want to do that. And that would be the end of it. But is that what happened? No. That was his out card. That was his way of getting out. But unfortunately, it backfired. And it backfired big time. Because look at their response in verse 3 and 4. So all the people broke off their golden earrings, which were in their ears, and brought them to Aaron. He received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with a graving tool and made a molded calf. Oh boy, this isn't good. They gladly bring their earrings. He thought they'd say, no, that's not a good idea. But instead, they brought them to him. And he makes a golden calf. And things get out of hand even more, because when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. Then they rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings, and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Things really got out of hand really quickly. It's almost like the people were incited by Aaron because he wasn't standing firm. And then Aaron is almost incited because of their determination. And then we get to the part where they have this big, massive party, licentious living. I've read stuff that state that this was like a big orgy over this golden calf. Things got out of hand really, really, really quickly. So what's happening with Moses while all of this is going on down in the camp? Moses is meeting with God, and God finally has to turn and say, hey, Moses, something's going on. Verse number 7, then the Lord said to Moses, go, get down, for your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. And then verse 10, now therefore let me alone that my wrath may burn hot against them and I may consume them and I will make of you a great nation. Your people? Were these Moses' people? No, they were not. And God wants to consume them? I always found this part of the story a little bit interesting. But I think what God is doing, he's trying to test Moses. He's trying to see what kind of leader he truly is. And we look at Moses' response. Now, I added this next text in this morning in my further study, so it's not on the screen, but we're going to read Exodus 32, verses 11 through 13. Then Moses pleaded with the Lord, his God, and said, Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak and say, he brought them out to harm them, to kill them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce wrath and relent from this harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have spoken of, I will give your descendants, and they shall be inherit it forever. And the spirit of prophecy further clarifies what's going on here. Now, this is a long quote, but bear with me. I think it makes a great point. Moses discerned ground for hope where there appeared only discouragement and wrath. The words of God, let me alone, he understood not to forbid, but to encourage intercession, implying that nothing but the prayers of Moses could save Israel, but that if thus entreated, God would spare his people. God had signified that he disowned his people. He had spoken of them to Moses as thy people, which thou broughtest out of Egypt. But Moses humbly disclaimed the leadership of Israel. They were not his, but God's, thy people, which thou hast brought forth with great power and with a mighty hand. Wherefore, he urged, should the Egyptians speak and say, for mischief did he bring them out, to slay them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth. During the few months since Israel left Egypt, the report of the wonderful deliverance had spread to all the surrounding nations. Fear and terrible foreboding rested upon the heathen. All were watching to see what the God of Israel would do for his people. Should they now be destroyed, their enemies would triumph, and God would be dishonored. The Egyptians would claim that their accusations were true. Instead of leading his people into the wilderness to sacrifice, he had caused them to be sacrificed. They would not consider the sins of Israel. The destruction of the people whom he had so signally honored would bring reproach upon his great name. How great the responsibility resting upon those whom God has highly honored to make his name a praise in the earth. With what care should they guard against committing sin, to call down his judgments and to cause his name to be reproached by the ungodly? See, what Moses is trying to say is, hey, God, if you do this, your name is going to be mud. No one's going to follow you. And he's trying to tell God, hey, these are your people. These aren't my people. And so Exodus 32, verse 14 says, so the Lord relented from the harm which he said he would do to his people. So really, Moses interceded on behalf of the children of Israel. I'm not sure if Moses truly influenced God in relenting, or if God was truly testing him to see what kind of leader he was. So there's many examples of the Bible, in the Bible, of people that were that influenced others. King Ahab, he kind of influenced the whole nation of Israel in a terrible, wicked way, didn't he? King Solomon, 1 Kings 11:4, for it was so when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart again after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. So he was led astray. He was influenced the other direction by all of those wives that he had. Now, we do know from Bible that he did come back, which is good news. But in turn, he was an influence on others. Daniel, the three Hebrew worthies, they were a great influence on King Nebuchadnezzar, who we're told is going to be in heaven because of their witness. Paul was a great influence on those around him. I think the great ultimate individual would be Jesus. He has a great influence, and he is the one we should be emulating and following. So, how do we have a good influence on others? I'm sure everybody here doesn't want to be like Aaron. We want to be more like Moses or Jesus or Paul or one of those individuals. So, How do we have a good influence on others? Well, number one, we must be careful who we spend time with. Steps to Christ, page 77, says, God is the source of life and light and joy to the universe. Like rays of light from the sun, like the streams of water bursting from a living spring, blessings flow out from him to all of his creatures. So, if God is a source of life and light and joy, shouldn't we be spending time with him? I think that is a great place to start. And we have the example of Jesus in Mark 1:35. Now in the morning, having risen a long while before daylight, he went out and departed to a solitary place, and there he prayed. He spent time with his heavenly Father. If Jesus needed that, how much more do we need that? Psalm 63, David is saying, Oh God, you are my God. Early I will seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water. And we are told in Jeremiah 29, verse 13, And you will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart. So we know that if we are truly seeking God with all of our hearts, we will find him. Continuing on in Steps to Christ, page 77, and wherever the life of God is in the hearts of men, it will flow out to others in love and blessing. When the love of Christ is enshrined in the heart like sweet fragrance, it cannot be hidden. Its holy influence will be felt by all with whom we come in contact. The Spirit of Christ in the heart is like a spring in the desert, flowing to refresh all and making those who are ready to perish eager to drink of the water of life. So this is how it works. As we are nourished, as we are spending time with God, we are wanting to pass those blessings on to others. It's like the word flow there. It's flowing from God to us to others. We're going to desire to pass it on. But step two in this process is we need to live by the principles that are set out in God's holy words. We must put good things in. As we look around at the world today, there's a lot of negative things out there. Our media choices need to be good and wholesome. That's why we have television stations like Blue Mountain Television that present good, wholesome things. We also need to look at our friendships. If we're spending time with somebody that's constantly negative and constantly pushing out toxic things, that's going to influence us as we're trying to influence others. So we need to take a look at our media choices. We need to take a look at our friendships and weed out those things that aren't helpful to us. You know, my mom used to have a saying. She said, garbage in, garbage out. And I suppose the reverse is true as well. If we put good things in, we're going to get good things out. If we put garbage in, we're going to get garbage out. Now, unfortunately, I'm speaking to myself here as well as everybody here today. Because I know there's times where I look at my life and I go, am I fully living the way that I should? Are my media choices affecting my outcome? And each one of us needs to examine our lives in that order. The Adventist Home, page 32. One well-ordered, well-disciplined family tells more in behalf of Christianity than all the sermons that can be preached. Such a family gives evidence that the parents have been successful in following God's directions and that their children will serve him in the church. Their influence grows, for as they impart, they receive to impart again. The father and mother find helpers in the children who give to others the instruction received in the home. The neighborhood in which they live is helped, for in it they have become enriched for time and for eternity. The whole family is engaged in the service of the Master, and by their godly example, others are inspired to be faithful and true to God in dealing with His flock, His beautiful flock. The greatest evidence of the power of Christianity that can be presented to the world as a well-ordered, well-disciplined family. This will recommend the truth as nothing else can, for it is a living witness of its practical power upon the heart. The best test of the Christianity of a home is the type of character begotten by its influence. Actions speak louder than the most positive profession of godliness. So I can go out and I can say that I'm living godly, but if my actions aren't living up to that, it's kind of a double standard. Really, what she's getting at here is actions speak louder than words. 1 Timothy 4:12, let no one despise your youth, but be an example to the believers in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, in purity. So we should be a good example to all people, not just believers, but to all people. How do we do that? By our words. Words can change someone's life for the good or the worse. How many of you heard that song, Home on the Range, where the chorus said, seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. Our words should uplift and encourage people, not bring them down. Our actions should be helping people improve their lives, not bringing them down. Our dress, what do we wear? Are we wearing things with inappropriate imagery? Are we reaching others for Christ? Are we well-dressed, well-manicured? Our deportment, are we kind? Are we courteous? Our countenance, do we have a smile or a frown on our face? You know, as Christians, we should be the sunniest people. We have a lot of good news. We have good things to share. I was at the drive-thru this past week, and the lady behind the window said something that made me crack a smile. And she's like, at least I got you to smile. And I thought, that means I probably wasn't in the first place. Oh, that's not a good thing. So we need to be sunny people where there's the clouds are not, it's not cloudy all day. Christ object lessons. Every soul is surrounded by an atmosphere of its own, an atmosphere. It may be charged with the life-giving power of faith, courage, and hope, and sweet with the fragrance of love, or it may be heavy and chill with the gloom of discontent and selfishness, or poisoned with the deadly taint of cherished sin, or poisonous with the deadly taint. By the atmosphere surrounding us, every person with whom we come in contact is consciously or unconsciously affected. This is a responsibility from which we cannot free ourselves. Our words, our acts, our dress, our deportment, even the expression of the countenance has an influence. Upon the impression thus made, there hang results for good or evil, which no man can measure. Every impulse thus imparted is seed sown, which will produce its harvest. It is a link in the long chain of human events, extending we know not whither. If, by our example, we aid others in the development of good principles, we give them power to do good. In their turn, they exert the same influence upon others, and they upon others still others. Thus, by our unconscious influence, thousands may be blessed. So we all have an influence, whether we realize it or not. It's our choice whether we want it to be an influence for good or we want to be an influence for bad. I heard about a river in China. The river is so toxic that everything in the river is dead. Why is that? Well, it's because they keep dumping so much chemicals and garbage into that river that everything, nothing can live in it. Everything along the edges, it's just dead. It's gone. It doesn't work. So do we want to be like that river? I would hope not. I'd hope we'd want to be more like the river we find in Ezekiel 47. Ezekiel's in vision, and he has this river of the river of life. And it shall be that every living thing that moves, whether the river, wherever the river goes, will live. There will be a great multitude of fish because these waters go there, for they will be healed and everything will live wherever the river goes. So my encouragement to us today is to be a river of good influence to those around. And the way we can do that is by spending time in our Word, in the Bible, getting to know Jesus and using Him as an example as we impart that good gifts to those around us. Our closing hymn today is hymn number 416 out of the Sing to the Lord book. So open your books to 416.